This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Today we're going to talk about America having pride in its power and what happens when that pride is broken, as the Bible prophesies will happen in our day. We're going to hear a report from Gino Chi, who works on our staff here at Trumpet Radio. He's going to share some fascinating history from a period when America had pride in its power and it properly exercised that power. That's our second segment after I talk about this subject for a bit and how this principle even applies to us on an individual level. In our third segment, we'll switch gears and talk about hard work. A frequent guest on this program and hard worker, Jorg Mardian, has some interesting thoughts on how hard work is necessary in life and in many different aspects of life in order to be a success. Jorg is a personal trainer and a nutritionist, and he works with people all the time on improving their health. He says your work habits can unlock hidden power to build a healthy life. And I'll conclude with a last word about an article from a woman who disagrees with the feminist slogan, "The future is female," but you'll be amazed at what she says the future actually is. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. As I was walking through a hotel in Houston recently, a portrait on the wall caught my eye. It was a picture of a frail old man in a tuxedo, and on closer inspection, I saw that this man had a glint in his eye, a toughness. There was an inscription underneath the painting that said, "David Mitzner, founder of RIDA Development, survivor, visionary, philanthropist, April 1915 to September 2016. Well, that definitely piqued my curiosity. And next to the painting, there was a copy of a speech by Senator Ted Cruz to the United States Senate delivered March 26th, 2015. And it was a speech about David Mitzner. The details of his life were there in this speech. Mitzner was born to Jewish parents living in Poland. During World War II, he lost his entire family to the Holocaust. He survived 8 years in a Soviet gulag. He escaped and made it to America in 1949. He was about 34 years old at the time. He had $17 in his pocket, didn't speak a word of English, had no relatives to rely on. He got a job working for a hosiery manufacturer, and eventually he got into real estate, and he ended up building a company that created thousands and thousands of jobs. He had holdings around Texas and even in Poland. And even at 100 years old, this man was still going into the office to keep his business operating the way that he wanted it to. I was truly inspired just looking at the scant details of his story that were available there on that wall. But, you know, America's history is full of these kinds of stories. Men who took advantage of the unparalleled opportunities offered by the free market system that America's founders established, and they turned their lives into successes that they couldn't have had anywhere else in the world at any point in human history. America has been the single greatest nation in history by so many measures. It has geographical advantages and natural resources, unprecedented wealth, industrial capacity, technological innovation, political strength, military might. It has made more David Mitzners than anywhere else on earth. It has offered more than any other nation in terms of individual liberty and social equality, economic opportunity. And on top of that, just what it has given in terms of international generosity, so many other factors. God gave this country many, many blessings, including the most unique founding in thousands of years. And he provided moral infrastructure that was needed to acquire and sustain national greatness. This nation has so much power and so much to take rightful pride in. If we had healthy pride in our power, people would be celebrating stories like David Mitzner and aspiring to replicate them and to follow in the steps of men like that. That would be our focus. But sadly, we're suffering the curse that the pride of our power has been broken. This is what God said would happen to the nation that turned its back on him. You can read it in Leviticus 26. And I will break the pride of your power, and your strength shall be spent in vain. That is truly a curse, a horrifying curse. America still has plenty of power, but the pride in that power has been broken. Our national will is broken. After decades of work by enemies of the country, more and more Americans have become embarrassed about our history, embarrassed about what we've accomplished economically and in the world, just the dominance of America in the world. Now, this is really the result of a satanic attack on this nation. He has been very aggressive in turning the attention of this nation onto focusing on all of our supposed sins and weaknesses and constantly apologizing for everything and second-guessing ourselves. A nonprofit organization called the Foundation for Liberty and American Greatness, the acronym FLAG, is what they say on their website, dedicated to educating Americans about the values and principles that make our nation exceptional. Now, to show the need for such education, FLAG conducted a survey last month through the polling firm YouGov regarding national pride among different generations of U.S. citizens. Now, this was a survey of over 1,000 Americans, and the results of this survey were truly shocking. It says, well, really not shocking, but stunning. It shows that younger Americans, specifically those from ages 14 to 37, Generation Z and millennials, in their words, are becoming unmoored from the institutions, knowledge, and spirit traditionally associated with American patriotism. This report says younger generations of Americans are less patriotic than older generations. It says only 72% of millennials are proud to be American. So nearly 3 in 10 are not. 46% do not agree that America is the greatest country in the world. Nearly half. 38% do not agree that America has a history that we should be proud of. 1 in 8 millennials agree that America was never a great country and it never will be. 1 in 8. Now, what is informing this perverse notion of just how unexceptional America is? Here are a few more beliefs that were exposed by this survey. Half of younger Americans believe the United States is sexist, and half believe that the United States is racist, 49%. 46% say America is more racist than other countries. And 1 in 5 millennials believe the American flag is a sign of intolerance and hatred. 1 in 5 believe the American flag is a sign of intolerance and hatred. That is so sad. This perverse self-image, like a girl with an eating disorder looking at her frail body in the mirror and seeing a fat person. There's a reason why America has been such a magnet destination for immigrants the world over throughout its history. People don't flee America to go anywhere else in the world. There's a reason for that. Mr. Mitzner, that young Pole who escaped from a Soviet gulag and was able to come to America and turn his life into such a smashing success. He died just a year or two ago, but I wish he could sit down and have a conversation with these young Americans. He would have so much to teach them. If they would just look into his history, if they would study the history of him and an untold number of other success stories like his. But you know, in their ignorance, this poll says 47% of them believe America's future should be driven by socialism. 47% say that free markets are a bad idea. Now, these shameful numbers, they're just going to keep going up as long as our education system continues to focus on all of America's supposed faults and just doing everything that it can to foment grievances. In far too many cases, the history that today's students are learning is totally negative. And the true story of America's history is being ignored. Here are a few more of the numbers from this poll. 84% of Americans do not know the specific rights enumerated in the First Amendment. Younger Americans are half as likely as older Americans to know which presidents are on Mount Rushmore. And 44%, this is stunning, 44% of younger Americans believe Barack Obama had a bigger impact on America than George Washington. That is stunning ignorance. And this is America's future. Most of these people are already voting. Many of them are teaching the next generation. Some of them are entering politics. Now, what happens when a people has such a toxic view of itself? What happens when our belief in ourselves, our conviction about the nobility of our cause is destroyed? We hesitate, we waver, we fear, we disbelieve, we apologize. That is the spirit of the age. That is the spirit of cursed Israel. Power without pride in that power is the same as having no power, except it's more tragic. This is a vital subject to think on, because what is true nationally is also true individually. We need to live our lives in pursuit of the highest ideals: truth, righteousness, holiness, freedom, true freedom, underpinned by the truth of God. The truth will make you free, as Christ said. As we pursue those ideals, God blesses us and He empowers us. We become individually a stronger and stronger force for good in the lives of the people around us, in the community, in the world at large. God gives, for example, He gives a man a certain amount of masculine power in his role as a husband, as a father. And we need a right kind of pride in that power as individual men, as heads of household. A man needs pride in the masculine power that God has given him so he can use that power for good. You need that in order to do your job effectively, in order to be bold and ambitious. You need that to lead a wife and children. You need it to be a force for good in the lives of those around you. But we do have that spiritual enemy that wants the opposite, the same enemy that is attacking America and weakening this country in so many ways. Satan wants to get us to doubt. He wants to break our pride in our power. He wants to get individuals focused on sins and weaknesses and cause us to doubt and prevaricate and kowtow. Now, we definitely need an honest appraisal of our sins, and we need to be repenting of those, and we need to humble ourselves before God. But God wants us to be bold. He wants us to be people of strength. He wants His church to be bold and strong, to have godly pride in its spiritual power. Most of God's people in this era of church history, they're under the same curse that America is. The pride in their power is broken, and they can't do the work of God. The Trumpet's editor-in-chief talked about this in the very first book he wrote, Malachi's Message. He said, "This nation, America, has the greatest power of any nation on earth. It also lacks the will to use it." And he cited Leviticus 26:19. And then he said, "The WCG, the Worldwide Church of God at that time, today, has the greatest power to communicate God's truth that any church has ever had, but it also lacks the will to use it." We need pride in our spiritual power. As a church, it takes strong will to do the work of God. It takes passionate belief that we're right, that what we're doing is the right thing. The British Empire at its peak, it believed in what it stood for. It wanted to extend that cause out to the nations. That's the kind of pride we need in our spiritual cause. We know what we're doing is right and it's noble and the world needs it. That's what it takes for God's work to flourish. That kind of belief produces real boldness and ambition. As long as the U.S. and Britain had pride in their power, they flourished. But once that pride was broken because of our sins, that power was rendered useless. Sin breeds insecurity. It breeds doubt. Proverbs 28 and verse 1 says, the righteous are bold as a lion. If you believe in your cause, you are irrepressible. If you're plagued by doubt, then the faintest gust of adversity will blow you off course. If we're weak, God can do little with us. We need to be strong. We need to be power tools in His hand. In a recent Key of David program, Gerald Flory talked about the Lion of Judah. He said that if the Lion of Judah lives in you, you will have power. It's a very inspiring Key of David program. Go and watch that. Check that out and put that into practice in your life. That is really where the source of our power must come from. Let the Lion of Judah live in you and build your power and build a right and godly pride in that power. Cultivate the confidence and the conviction and the courage to use that power for good.
Voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
One example of America exercising pride in its power has been its relationship with the Philippines, as we will now hear in this report from Gino Chi.
The Philippines is a beautiful country. It's come a long way since its independence in July 4, 1946. Today, the Philippines ranks third in Asia for English proficiency. It also has an excellent literacy rate of almost 97%, according to UNESCO Institute of Statistics. And not only that, the Philippines now, today, is the 38th largest export economy in the world. That's amazing for that tiny nation. But the Philippines didn't do this alone. The Philippines was helped by one nation, and that one nation's leadership help impact this tiny nation that I call home. In the 15th century, the islands, approximately 7,641 of them, were ruled by different tribal kingdoms or indigenous kingdoms. And during this time, they took part in agriculture, in fishing, in shifting cultivation. And their religion was a mix of monotheism and polytheism. And in between those, there's also the ritualistic religion that they took part in. So there wasn't really a lot of development in the Philippines at this time. Then in 1521, Spain colonized the Philippines. And that lasted from 1521 to 1898. And during that time, there wasn't a lot of developments. It wasn't until 1863 that there was public education in the Philippines. And even then, the church controlled the curriculum, and less than one-fifth of those who went to school could read and write Spanish. So the majority of the Filipinos, my people, were illiterate and left in the dark. And this was a move by the Spanish government to control the Filipinos. The education that the Spanish colonizers introduced was mainly religious-based and controlled by the Roman Catholic Church. So Spanish education centered on religion, and the friars taught at those schools. So not a lot of development during that time in 1521 to 1898. Only a select few, many sons of the wealthy, were educated and were sent to other places to study. But in general, the Philippines was still in the dark at this time. But that all started to change in December 10, 1898, which was the signing of the Treaty of Paris. So in this treaty, Spain renounced all claim to Cuba, ceded Guam and Puerto Rico and the Philippines to the United States. And this was all started with the war originated in the Cuban struggle for independence, which began in February 1895. So Spain actually sold off all those territories for $20 million. So Philippines is under the American rule at this time in 1898. So at the end of that war, pressure was on the then president, William McKinley, to annex the Philippines to the U.S. And in an interview with the president, he says this, quote, "I confess I did not know what to do with them," talking about the Philippines. "I sought counsel from all sides, but got little help. I thought first we would take only Manila, which was the capital city, then Luzon, then other islands, perhaps also." So here, President William McKinley was confused or wasn't sure what he was going to do with the territory that he gained, specifically the Philippines. Continuing with the interview, he says this, quote, "I walked the floor of the White House night after night until midnight. And I am not ashamed to tell you, gentlemen, that I went down on my knees and prayed for light and guidance more than one night. And one night late, it came to me this way. I don't know how it was, but it came." End quote. And then President McKinley gives four options on what he could do with the Philippines. The first one was he thought that he couldn't give the Philippines back to Spain because he said that would be cowardly and dishonorable. The second option that he canceled was that he couldn't turn over the Philippines over to France or Germany because this would shift the balance in power and they were commercial rivals at that time. The third option that he thought of was allowing the Philippines to self-govern themselves. But he thought that this wasn't a good idea. He says this, quote, "We could not leave them to themselves. They were unfit for self-government and they would soon have anarchy and misrule worse than Spain's was." So with three of those options ruled out, the fourth one was the final solution that President McKinley thought to enact. And this is what he says in that fourth option, quote, "That there was nothing for us left to do but to take them all and to educate the Filipinos and uplift and civilize them and by God's grace do the very best we could by them as our fellow men for whom Christ also died." And here is a totally different mindset from all other colonizers that have occupied the Philippines. So America took this opportunity and made it their responsibility to give. And during this time, the United States was a powerful nation. They had the tools and the will and the power to help another nation. So unlike the previous colonizers, the Americans right away made educational reforms throughout the Philippines. The American colonizers thought to reform the whole system and use education as part of their colonization program. So at first, American soldiers built schools in conquered areas and the soldiers themselves were actually the first teachers. Soon after that, there weren't enough soldiers to teach that many Filipinos. So they passed the passage of Act No. 74, otherwise known as the Educational Act of 1901. Soldiers were replaced by trained teachers beginning in June 1901. So in June 1901, a group of around 1,000 volunteer teachers arrived in the Philippines. And then 2 months later, another batch of 600 teachers came via naval ship USS Thomas. And they were called themselves the Thomasites because of the ship that they arrived in. So the reform educational system introduced by the Americans encouraged more Filipinos in the field of teaching, so that succeeding generations were taught by Filipino teachers and the reliance on American teachers was going to decrease. So throughout the American colonization period, several universities, vocational schools, and normal schools were established around the country. So all around the Philippines, people or Filipino people were being taught English and being taught the basics of living. And more importantly, the law discarded the religious bias in the system of education. And it also promulgated the use of the English language as the official medium of instruction in all public schools and the teaching of the concept of democracy. And you see that effect even today. So the lasting legacy of American educational reforms in the Philippines is still felt to this day, with the Filipinos' continued English language proficiency and their undying support for democracy. So no other nation that has occupied the Philippines has helped it to grow and develop to what it is today than the United States of America. This one nation's leadership helped change this tiny nation of the Philippines. And I'm sure the American rule in the Philippines wasn't perfect, but the effects and the development it produced was positive and helped develop this country to what it is today. There is a poem by a British novelist that encapsulates what the Americans and the British people have done for a lot of nations. This poem actually talks specifically about the Americans or the US in regards to the Philippines and helping the Filipinos out. It says here, quote, "In patience to abide, to veil the threat of terror, and check the show of pride, by open speech and simple, 100 times made plain, to seek another's profit and work another's gain." And I think that really encapsulates what the US did for the Philippines. They sought another's profit and worked another's gain.
Well, thank you for that, Gino. That is really some fascinating history. When you look at the way the Philippines was before America came in under the rule of Spain, and I think in some ways you can also look at what's happening there now as America's influence is pulled back, and you see what the Philippines is becoming. You were talking about, I guess you mentioned there toward the end, that democracy is flourishing there. But in some ways, it seems like that trend is reversing as America's influence wanes. When I was there, I had the opportunity to visit there a few years ago, and it was amazing to me how much respect there still is for America and Americans there among the people that I associated with. But the it does seem like maybe that's reversing in recent years under President Duterte.
Yes, sir, that's true. I think the Filipinos still have a lot of respect for the Americans. I have a personal experience on that too. I actually brought my American friends to my hometown, and they were treated very nicely by everyone there in my city. So I think that's a general sentiment of the Filipinos, that they like the Americans, they know the good that's been brought upon the country by them. But as you said, there is a shift towards China, there's a shift towards other Asian nations and being reliant upon them, and mainly because of our president. Our president is very adamant of talking about China and its budding relationship with the Philippines. And what it is really is our president sees America leaving the Philippines alone, and that in turn leaves a hole in that area. And so President Duterte,
he has to turn somewhere in a sense.
He has to turn somewhere, and he's going towards China. And I think slowly the Filipinos and the Philippines in general is turning towards China. It might not be as fast as, oh, we don't like the Americans now, we like China. Yeah. But it's slowly getting there.
Yeah. Well, it is interesting to put those recent developments in the context that you're describing here, and really some history that every American should be very familiar with. We've been talking with Gino Chi. He's one of our staff members here at Trumpet Radio, and he produces videos for us at thetrumpet.com. Really fascinating. Thank you very much for sharing that with us.
Thank you. That was fun.
is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Hard work. Some people consider it too stressful. Others say it's everything in life. Work is definitely an important part of our life. If we do it right, it can help us build character. It can keep our mind and body strong. In fact, personal trainer and nutritionist Jorg Mardian, who works with people all the time on improving their health, says your work habits can unlock hidden power to build a healthy life. We have him from his office in British Columbia to talk about this. Hello, Jorg.
Hi there.
So first, I'd like to know just what got you thinking about this topic.
Well, hard work is something I've done all my life. I've been in construction many years, and it really isn't a trait that you can slack off at for very long. Be called out. So there's certain ways you can go about a work, you know, like we're told work hard. And what is that meaning? And is it something that's physical? Is it something that we just sweat at, you know, put in our toil and labor? Or can we sit there as a, from a farm worker or a factory worker to a CEO and use hard work or working hard as a necessary skill for life? Mm-hmm. So really working hard at anything it is to achieve success is hard work. I mean, a lot of people think that real success is an accident. They really do. Or that some people are just talented and, you know, they kind of inherit that. And I saw a quote from Stephen King and I had to laugh because he said, talent is cheaper than table salt. He says, what separates the talented individual from the successful one is a lot of hard work. Mm-hmm. You know? And we can ask any of the world's most successful self-made billionaires. I mean, they're gonna have some strength. They're going to have some talents that give them a little bit of a head start, of course. Some of them, not all of them. But in the end, you know, they all have one dominant commonality, and that's hard work. So if you ask them, if you ask anyone and you say, put it down into a nutshell, they'll say it's hard work is the equalizer that makes it possible to achieve extraordinary performance, not just ordinary, extraordinary. And then, of course, that translates into benefit for every part of life. Mm-hmm. No. Now, the unique part about the path to life, to the path to success, is the commonality behind it. You know, the anatomy of hard work looks similar to everybody who applies it. That's the beautiful thing. It doesn't discriminate.
So it seems like there would be a lot of people who would tend to think life is what happens outside of work, that you work in order to make the money, to pay the bills so that you can do the things that you really want to do. And on the other hand, you have people who seem to think that life is work and that there's really nothing happening outside of the work arena, that they're willing to sacrifice just about everything else outside in order to achieve uncommon success, whether it's financial or some kind of a measure of success in whatever they're devoting their life to. You talk about a life work balance. I'm assuming you're talking about making sure that your work is something that is meaningful, that you can devote your energies to and feel like you're contributing something of value. And then there are other things in your life as well. Is that right?
Yeah, that is correct. We have to put all of those things together. Like you said, some people just take work and it's one part of their life, and others take their personal life and separate that completely. I really don't, because one affects the other. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's really where the health aspects come in. And that's why some people are going to succeed and others never will, because they just don't make that connection. It has a lot to do with how we approach our work. So if you take a lazy worker, you know, everything to them is hard work. I mean, it's just a negative part of it. You know, it's too hard. I don't want to do it. Now, if that worker can't get his act together when he's paid to do it, he's not going to get his act together in other parts of his life when he's not paid, you know, such as marriage or raising the kids or setting and keeping goals. They're all hard work, aren't they? And I find it hard to believe that a worker like that can also be diligent in staying healthy, because it takes discipline to apply a nutritious diet to your life. And it takes discipline as well to exercise. I mean, exercise, I look at my clients and they all say, well, this is hard, this hurts, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, yes, it does, because that's another commonality to all aspects of our life. If you want to succeed, you have to apply hard work. So the workaholic is somewhat the same. Now, he's going to work hard, of course, but he's still unbalanced because he has such a single-minded obsession with his long work hours. And that's really to the detriment of his health. You know, the studies show that stress harm people who overwork because there's so many biological changes in the body. And that leads to stroke, coronary heart disease, and even death. So that's well proven. Now, you have to think about it logically. If work dominates your life to such an extent, you're not getting that exercise, you're not sleeping properly, you're working far too late into the night. In the morning, you get up and you grab a coffee at the office canteen. Mm-hmm. You're going to down endless cups of coffee all day because you're just tired. You've worked too hard. At night, the cycle continues. You're going to heat up a TV dinner and you're going to slouch on the couch, mm-hmm. because that's what you have energy for. Right. So, and then there's also a third component to that. There's a balanced hard worker, and he sits somewhere in the middle of that equation. So it doesn't matter where he's at. I mean, you can work in a factory or you can be the head of a company. What separates those two people is the focus and being deliberate on results, you know, doing the best that that person can with the abilities that he has. So it's really a cause and effect relationship that helps you blast through obstacles, you know, better than others who have less resolve. And you have to work at it. But here's the point. What gets you to this point, though? You know, you can say, I work hard. And a lot of people do work hard. But what gets a person to embrace hard work?
That's an excellent question. it is interesting. It seems like some people sort of have a natural tendency to gravitate toward that, while others seem more naturally resistant to it. And like you're saying, it does manifest itself in all different aspects of our lives. It tends to be that if you have things together in one area, that tends to translate into greater success in the other, because it reflects just your willingness to discipline yourself and do what needs to be done rather than taking the path of least resistance.
Yes, that is correct. In my younger days, I worked extremely hard, extremely long hours. I was young and I had the energy to do that, but there was a great unbalance in my life. And I can't say when I was younger that it was always the healthiest thing to do, because I did, when I'm talking about lack of sleep and I'm talking about things that suffer in life, I was going through that for quite a while. I always tell my clients, I'm built for work. I just work. I don't know what else to do if I'm not working, but I do try to find a balance. Now, the biggest factor is when we define success, when we define work habits, is a person's ability to set clear and balanced goals. You know, goals tell you where you're going. If I'm driving somewhere home and I'm a couple hours away, if I don't know where I'm going, I see in my mind exactly where I'm going. If I don't have that picture, I'm going to end up somewhere else in another town. Mm-hmm. The thing about goals is that they don't limit us to experiences that we receive passively or painlessly, right? They're not the easy way. So they're actually the driving force that control the flow of our life. And that's really how I look at that, because it gives you the vision to see where you're going to end up. And goals also build enthusiasm, determination, and I think they bring a ton of responsibilities and self-control along the way. So it really makes us the driver of our life, and it steers us into the realm of what we can call real accomplishments.
You mentioned success requires hard work, and it seems like people pretty much naturally tend to understand that when it comes to career. The specifics that you were talking about with nutrition and diet and exercise, I think people can recognize, yeah, it takes work to keep yourself healthy. But I think it's maybe in some ways easy for people to fail to recognize that when it comes to relationships with your family, your friends, that it takes work, hard work, to succeed in that area of your life. And spiritually, your relationship with God also takes hard work. It's not something that's just going to naturally be good unless you're willing to devote the effort into it.
Well, that's absolutely true. And again, we have to separate work and the financial aspect, and that's what drives this world, right? But if we set goals for our life, I mean, I set goals for my marriage. Mm-hmm. I always set a goal and I say, I want to end up in a better place always. My marriage has to be stronger. And it's the same way with my relationship with God. It has to be stronger all the time. And I have to build an enthusiasm. You know, I have to be determined to fight being tired. I have to be responsible about what I do in my daily life. And the self-control to put away all other aspects of life that distract us, that's hard work. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not easy. And it's not just picking up a shovel and throwing dirt. It's getting rid of the habits that we have and just building this clear vision of where we're going, and then just be driven to go towards that. Drive that car as fast as you can, you know, and that to me is hard work, getting rid of those distractions that are everywhere. I mean, I can pick up my phone, my tablet, I can turn on my computer, the television can be blaring. If you're not careful, we can go to the store and get distracted everywhere, and we forget the priorities in life. Mm-hmm. And that crowds out what we really need to work at. So personal life and relationships and keeping a strong, relaxed mind and working towards those goals and writing them down, you know, keep a journal of your goals and look at them daily. I find that so such a good habit to work towards, because my mind, our short-term memory just spills over with facts all the time. We mm-hmm. keep so many in it. But, you know, I look at my phone, I turn it on, and I have a list of my priorities. Hmm. It's a great way to conceptualize my goals and say, where am I going? And what have I done to work towards this? Right. Have I done anything? Have I put in the time and the effort? You know, and I find that can be as hard as digging a ditch, because I can dig a ditch all day long. It's going to be tiring, but I know exactly how I'm going to end up. Sometimes there's uncertainty in some of the goals in our personal lives. Mm. You know, we really have to put everything together and make sure that we're running the race towards our goal, not just walking, but making sure that we end up there in a strong position.
You kind of have to step back and evaluate and look at how are you doing relative to those goals. It just always strikes me how, you know, I really have no time to waste. It's really easy, say, in that moment of distraction to lose sight of that. But whenever you step back and look at the big picture, you realize that every day, every moment, every hour that you have to put toward those important goals, it is precious, and it must not be wasted. And this aspect of goals I find interesting, because I just, especially working with college students, I require in some of my classes, I'll ask students to write down their goals for this or that, or I'll ask them to do a certain amount of self-evaluation. And a lot of times it's a very general, you know, I'm going to be nicer to people, or, you know, they'll say something that it's not a goal. It's maybe just a wish or something that, like, it would be nice if I did a better job, if I read more, or and they stated in very general terms, but that's not something that's going to change your actions in the moment. It's very easy to say something like that and move on and forget about it. Where if the kind of goal that actually drives action would be the one that I'm going to do this for 15 minutes each morning when I get up, before I start my day, or at lunch, while I'm having my lunch, I'm going to be reading this, or whatever the case might be. It's something that is tangible, and it gives you that accountability whether or not you did it.
Right. And none of what you say make me think that I'm not going to have to put in a lot of time and effort.
Right.
I think if we want to achieve some really big and interesting goals, we do have to put them down. We have to make them important in our life. I've got kids, and I drill that into my kids. You know, I'll say something. I say, did you actually lock that in, or did it slip out the side out of your ear?
Mm-hmm.
You know, kids are famous for that, because you'll ask me, say, I didn't hear you. Well, that's the thing. We have to lock those goals in. We have to make that point interesting, and we have to learn to fall in love with what we're doing. So is that goal something that's important? Yes, it is. I'm writing it down. Do I love what I'm doing here? And do I love the process? Do I love the process of hard work? Yes. Is this process going to make me better? Is this going to make me healthier in mind, in body, in the spiritual? Well, most times you can answer yes to that question as well. Now, it's not always going to be pleasant, and it's not going to be free of pain, but it's a potent tool that's going to lead us, I think, to continued growth, success, and that health that we're looking for spiritually and physically in every aspect of our life.
We've been talking with Jörg Mardian about hard work and how to do it in a way that builds your health and builds your life. Keep an eye on thetrumpet.com for an article from him about this subject. Jörg, we sure appreciate your time. That's fascinating stuff.
It's been a pleasure.
It's time for today's last word.
The liberal left is comically self-contradictory. When a Christian missionary recently tried to, quote, bring Jesus to the remote Indian Ocean island of Sentinel, and tribesmen riddled his body with darts and dragged his corpse across the beach, liberals declared, those people have every right to defend themselves against foreign intrusion. That man was killed not by the Sentinelese, but by his own arrogance. Now, at the same time, when Americans deployed tear gas to repel a convoy of foreigners from illegally entering the United States, liberals screamed, those people have every right to come into this country. How dare America defend its borders from foreign intrusion? These kinds of oxymorons are everywhere. Liberals, having cast aside principles, virtue, and truth itself, plunge themselves into thickets of impossible moral conundrums. They say somehow simultaneously that women are entitled to freedom from sexual harassment, and that pornography is healthy, and that the Bible's prohibitions against lust, rape, fornication, and adultery are oppressive and irrelevant, and that criticizing Muslims who oppress and even rape women is Islamophobic, and that all men are rapists and potential rapists, and they should not be trusted. And if a man denies an accusation of sexual misconduct, he's a liar, without question. And that if a biological male says he realizes he's really a woman, then he's telling the truth. He must be believed, without question, and should then be allowed to participate in women's sports and to access women's locker rooms and bathrooms. And that gender is a social construct, and biology has no bearing on whether we are male or female, and that women are inherently better leaders than men, and the country would be better off if we had more women in power. All these things can't all be true. And one consequence of all of these incongruities is that liberals often end up fighting other liberals over who has more virtue. One self-righteous liberal tries to signal multicultural bona fides and gets attacked by another self-righteous liberal for cultural appropriation. I have a confession to make. When I see this kind of liberal infighting, it gives me a certain pleasure. But this is what piqued my interest at a recent headline at Rewire News, a left-wing website. Its author has recognized some of these self-contradictions and is trying to square the circle. Recent political gains by women have given rise to the feminist slogan, "The future is female." This author, who identifies herself as a white heterosexual female, has concluded, as in the headline, "No, the future is not female. It's non-binary." This is what the article said. "I know it's supposed to be a forward-looking slogan that envisions a time where all women are given our due in politics and culture, but the statement reinforces some very backward ideologies. Whiteness, binaries, and oppression go together. Black, white, male, female, gay, straight, the list goes on and on. We can't embrace a pithy but exclusionary slogan, even one that asserts that we need more non-men in leadership, especially non-white and non-straight ones. We all have moral and ethical obligations to decolonize our thoughts and language, rooting out binaries that label and devalue people. And that includes even activist spaces, because anyone who reinforces these binaries, whether intentionally or not, is participating in upholding the oppressive institutions of a white patriarchal society." So there you have it. I suppose it was inevitable that left-wing feminists promoting more women into power would fall afoul of the left-wing non-binary crowd. But liberal virtues are constantly shifting. Yesterday's righteousness is today's oppression. A liberal victory, quote unquote, is a mirage. It's always beyond the horizon. Before it's reached, a faction has broken off to follow a new, more radically revolutionary flag. This author says, "The future is one where we don't push a binary norm. The future should be non-binary, period." Now just try to imagine the world that she's suggesting here, a world devoid of black and white, where everything is a gradient of grays, and we're literally unable to make the simplest distinctions between male and female, or even between ones and zeros. Through the prophet Isaiah, in Isaiah 5 and verse 20, God says this, "Woe unto them that call evil good and good evil, that put darkness for light and light for darkness, that put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter." This inversion of reality describes our world very well, as it already is. But I wonder how much farther the world is going to go toward obliterating binary thinking altogether, and refusing to even acknowledge differences between good and evil, darkness and light, bitter and sweet. What this author of this article will not openly acknowledge, so you can detect it in her tone, is this. This fanciful world she's describing, which does not and cannot exist, can only be pursued through authoritarianism. She says the future should be binary, period. Now, this sounds like a fringe view, but the reality is people in power are increasingly agreeing with radical ideas like this. What happens to those who disagree? What happens to those who stubbornly refuse to play along? To learn more about why this thinking is so dangerous, request a free copy of our booklet, Redefining Family. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Gino Chi and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Winston Churchill. The world is divided into peoples that own the government and governments that own the peoples. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.